This is Brian Bunk of the Oral History Project, and today is June 14th of the year 2000. I'm in the offices of Jan Shepherd, and we're continuing the interview that we began a few weeks ago. We concluded the last session talking about the UW network, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Issues Network, and you were discussing the debates within the organization about whether or not to become an official affiliated UW system group.
Yeah, at least one of our meetings, and perhaps even a couple, we discussed our relationship with the system and whether it should be in some way formalized, because it was not a formally recognized committee or organization. It was an informal committee of people who basically took the day off to get together and talk about these issues at various, and we would move around the system to various campuses. I would say most of the meetings were here at Madison, but we did meet at Green Bay, we met at Milwaukee, we met at Whitewater, we met at Oshkosh.
And were these monthly or every couple of months? Or?
For the first couple of years, I think a couple of years we had three times a year. Most years it was twice a year. So it was usually in the fall and then in the late spring, or sometimes early in the spring semester, usually more towards the end of the spring semester.
So these questions about whether to become an official part,
the question took place
over several years.
Then. Yes, it would come up again year after year. The question was whether to approach system in a more aggressive, assertive manner, to ask them to recognize us. We had been in touch with people at system, primarily with Tessa Rennes from the, she was at that point the special assistant to the president on minority affairs, I think was the title, and Evan Norris, who was an academic planner. And in speaking, in fact, Evan and Tess came to one of our meetings that was in Milwaukee after we had one of these discussions. So the discussion was really, should we become official, or should we ask to become officially recognized? Should we push for that? Or should we continue as an informal group that tried to make change among ourselves and then take the change back to our individual campuses? And I think the question about that was the advantage or disadvantage of being recognized officially. The advantage may be that people wouldn't have to take a day off of work. It would not be something you would have to go and sort of beg your supervisor to let you do. Some of the people there did not have to take a day off of work. Their supervisor was supportive, and it related to the work they were doing on a day-in and day-out basis, and the supervisor said, fine, I want you to be involved. This is good that we're working on this and that we're working with the system. For some of the people, for example, and particularly for some of the faculty who really, it's not like they were working in student services per se, and their dean or chair was not necessarily feeling this was appropriate or connected to their work. So they would come, but they would come on a day they weren't teaching or something, or clearly was not within their, or they weren't feeling that they could talk to their direct supervisor in terms of it being within the purview of what they normally did.
Was there any cases of people who were maybe pressured not to, or they couldn't, or they maybe suffered some sort of ill effects, whether?
I think we probably didn't see those people because they didn't come.
So
I don't know. But there was the sense that, and then there were some people who were maybe in student services but not necessarily directly working with LGBT issues, but themselves had an interest in the issues, and just maybe because they were either an out lesbian and gay person or maybe not even out on their campus but still offering support to other students on the campus, they wanted to come and be involved because they were concerned about the issues. But it was, they felt it likely that were the group to get officially recognized, they would no longer be the appointed person, that it would be someone in housing or someone in counseling or someone in one of the offices that maybe had a clearer direct connection to student service provision for lesbian gay students. So I think there wasn't a clear sense in the group as to which was better. I think there, after the discussion, there was a sense that the advantage of being recognized, it would be visibility. It would be more easily being able to schedule the meetings, getting perhaps some campus support for paying for the meetings, providing a location, all of those things, just the sort of nuts and bolts administration piece. Having a centralized person to be just managing the group, that was difficult because there was a fair amount of administration involved in sending emails and notifying different people. So the advantage would be that it would be more more formalized, and it would give us the advantage of having a formal structure. The disadvantage was that we weren't sure what system would say, that we were working, we were being able to meet, we were having access to system people, even though it wasn't formalized, and that it might change our membership base. And that, did we want people assigned to be in this group, or did we really want people who were interested in being in the group and wanted to be in the group?
How large was the group? I mean, was it a kind of thing where there'd be people could just come and if they were interested in joining,
yes.
I suppose people dropped out sort of.
Yeah, we just had kind of a mailing list of people that have contacts in the different campuses, and we asked people to spread the word and bring whoever they wanted. Mm-hmm. I would say we generally had at least between 30 to 50 people at the meeting. So it would be a big circle.
Mm-hmm.
And some meetings that included students and some meetings it didn't. I can't remember if we discussed that at the last tape. Whether students should be involved or not was actually a relatively big issue as well, and that changed over the time.
Oh, okay. I don't think we got into that, so we can...
Okay. So at the meeting following the one where we really had a more... where most of the meeting was devoted to whether we wanted to formalize, what we decided is that for the next meeting, which was going to be in Milwaukee, we would invite Tessa Rennes and Evan Norris to come. And they both came. And what they said at that meeting, and I'm sorry I don't have the year, it was probably, I think it was 1993. And at that meeting, what both Tess and Evan said is that they were happy to work with us, happy to be a contact, that we should keep in touch with them, talk with them, but they did not feel that we should become formalized. They didn't feel we would be able to become formalized, mm-hmm. that system would back it at this point, and that it would be a wiser move for us to wait, use their resources in the way, in the informal way that we could, but not push to get formal recognition, and that they felt that the political situation at that time would not be friendly
mm-hmm.
to formally recognizing this group. And so that's what we decided to do.
And it's stayed that ever since?
It has to this point. Last year, meaning in the fall of 99, we got a message from system. It went, I believe, to people in the chancellor's office who then got in touch with me. From system saying that system, the president's office, had an interest in knowing what kinds of services were being provided to LGBT people on all the different campuses, that they wanted each campus to produce a list of what was happening on their campus, and that they were going to be reviewing this, and somewhere in there was the sense that they were reviewing it towards the end of seeing whether some sort of system-wide committee should be established.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the last I've heard.
Were they aware that there already was an informal system? They must have been.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly told them in our session, in the what UW system, I mean UW-Madison provided,
mm-hmm.
we mentioned it.
So it's still ongoing and may change then
right.
in the near future.
The last couple of years, I haven't been as involved in it. It has been meeting, but not probably only once a year, and the meetings have been pretty small. I think it's been largely an administration problem. We haven't had anybody who's been willing to take on the administration. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work to maintain the mailing lists and get the messages out and schedule the meetings and plan the rooms and
right. Get
speakers.
You had mentioned just a few minutes ago that there was some question about whether or not to include students.
Right. At the very first meeting we had here in Madison, what we did is we had advertised it and discussed, really thought about it as an opportunity for staff and faculty to talk about issues that affected them as well as issues that affected students. and for an opportunity for staff and faculty to be talking among themselves, basically really without students.
Mm-hmm.
We had invited students with the concept that students could have their own meeting separately, that we would reserve a room, and if any students accompanied the people that came, they could meet separately to form their own network.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we proceeded for a couple of years, maybe not a couple of years, a couple of meetings probably. And then there was talk that why were we excluding students and shouldn't students be here and aren't students what we're all about? And so we had those discussions. And again, there was, I think, some differences of opinion within the group. I don't think there was ever a sense that we wanted to exclude students.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and I think that this was also the reasoning initially, was that the feeling was that these were issues that were sometimes very difficult, sometimes politically sensitive, and that faculty and staff wanted an opportunity to talk about them with other campuses and other people in a pretty honest way, and that we didn't necessarily want students to be hearing some of the not always positive things that we had to say about what was happening on the campus, that
mm-hmm.
we didn't think that that was always the best for students or the best, that wasn't the public face we wanted to be presented, yet we wanted to be able to talk about the real political challenges if there was some either formal or informal homophobia going on, the kinds of challenges we maybe were facing from outside legislators, that
mm-hmm.
those weren't necessarily things we felt appropriate for students to be hearing about. Also, I think I always felt that there was a need for faculty and staff who struggled so hard on these issues to have an opportunity to talk with one another about them honestly and not have to worry about the response of students, that you don't
right.
want students to know that you're not necessarily feeling supported
mm-hmm.
or that you feel there's some bigger problems, that those aren't things that are helpful for the students learning, that you want the students to be able to be moving through as smoothly as they can, and you want to be helping them over the hurdles, not exaggerating the hurdle. And you wouldn't be exaggerating the hurdles, but there's some hurdles students shouldn't have to
mm-hmm.
be worried about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt it was important that was, in fact, what isolated faculty and staff on campuses really didn't have, was the opportunity to talk about these issues with like-minded people. That the sort of putting the good face on it, they had lots of experience with.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the challenge we faced, was how do we not forget about the students and invite students and help them do the networking, yet also support the faculty and staff that are facing
mm-hmm.
a lot of hurdles themselves.
Was the sort of parallel student network very successful?
I think not as successful, because they somehow felt, well, we were doing the important or interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wanted to know what the people downstairs were talking about, or the people.
Right.
So after probably 3 or 4 meetings where we kind of didn't openly invite students, or if students came, they were on their own, we started to incorporate students. And then we had several meetings like that. My perspective was that really wasn't as useful, that there were times when it became the students being angry at the situation and putting the people, the faculty and staff who had come, into a pretty defensive position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't coming to this to be defensive, they were coming to get help for themselves.
Right.
So I felt that it really didn't accomplish anything, didn't help the students, and it certainly didn't help the faculty and staff who came.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that after that combination is when our numbers started getting a little bit smaller. Then there was a later incarnation when I was not, after I had moved out of the liaison role, when we decided to make it more of a small working group, so it was more just identified people that were going to be coming each time, so that we didn't have these 30-person roundtables.
Right.
And we probably had 3 or 4 meetings like that. I did attend a couple of those, but not all of them. And they were useful in that they probably were a little bit more focused, and I think more action-oriented. But I do think we lost some momentum because he didn't have as many people, and there was mm-hmm. more of a workload on a fewer number of people.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, the big meetings, while they weren't action-oriented, and it wasn't like there was necessarily a result, I think they addressed the issues of visibility and energizing people,
mm-hmm.
and helping people address isolation, giving people ideas, not giving people an action plan, go back and do this, but giving people ideas that they could then take to their own campus and personalize mm-hmm. for the campus. And that was really the view that I had of the goal of the group, was really just to keep people sort of excited and connected and, mm-hmm. and networked.
Do you think that, I imagine that there was probably a growth of visibility and organizations on all the campuses
yes.
during the life time or up till now?
Yeah.
And do you think that if the LGBT services and presence became more visible or more at some of these other campuses when it wasn't back in, say, 1992, mm-hmm. that would tend to lessen the need or people coming to this sort of thing?
Probably. I think it would. And I think the issues have changed, too. I think that, and I don't know for sure about some of the smaller campuses, but I think that probably the service and the visibility issue for LGBT students is much better mm-hmm. now at the smaller campuses. And that the issue really now probably the largest issue is now domestic partnership coverage for faculty and staff and for students at some campuses.
Mm-hmm.
On our campus, students have the coverage, so for on our campus, it's just faculty and staff coverage that's the issue. And those are issues that are being addressed by other networks, by there is a statewide, what are they called? State Employees Network, which is called Wisconsin Legislators. I can't remember the name of that organization. Larry Davis on our campus is very involved, as is Dan Ross in that organization. And then there's an organization called Action Wisconsin, which is just a statewide network of people not connected to the university per se, just a statewide network mm-hmm. of people looking at LGBT issues, and one of their highest priorities is domestic partnership coverage mm-hmm. for state employees. So I think that the venues for those issues is not necessarily on campus anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like an issue that would be better served or better dealt with through a kind of official system committee or through larger networks than just individuals from campuses
right.
getting together.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a much more organized and
yes.
pressure
right.
being applied for that sort
right.
of thing.
Pride
yeah.
in Wisconsin Government is the name of that other organization.
Okay.
And that's a network of network of Wisconsin employees, state of Wisconsin employees, addressing things like domestic partnerships. So those mm-hmm. two organizations, Action Wisconsin and Pride in Wisconsin Government together, are working on domestic partnership coverage, not only for university employees, but for state employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we can move on, I guess, maybe, or move back, sort of, to the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee, the GLIC Committee. I think we sort of took that diversion to the network from
okay.
there, but maybe we could talk, I think we discussed the members and sort of the background of the group, but I don't think we got to the report, which was issued on January 23, 1992. And there was a series of recommendations there, and I just listed them and some of the main parts, and I thought we could maybe go down and talk a little bit about some of the recommendations, and maybe you could comment on them if you have any specific comments about the sorts of things that were planned and maybe why they came about.
Sure.
The first one, I guess, there was a series of different areas that were addressed, and these are all in the report, which there's a copy of in your file in the Oral History Project. So the first one was the Dean of Students' Offices, and there were several recommendations regarding a kind of establishing a permanent liaison, some about police and security, and then health service issues.
Okay, and the permanent liaison is how I got the role. I was not a full-time liaison. The report, I believe, requested actually a half-time.
Yeah, I think so.
I think. And at that time, the dean said we were a very small staff, as we still are, And she said she just did not feel she had the person power to have ask someone to commit half of their time to this, but that she would appoint someone as a liaison. And she asked me to do that. I agreed. At that point, I think we agreed that I would be quarter time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the role I was in from when the report was released until 1995. Police and security, I'm sorry, I'm not remembering what that recommendation was.
These were issues that were listed under the Dean of Students' Office,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why it would be listed under the Dean of Students' Office, since that's its own division.
Mm-hmm.
Health Service, because Health Service had very recently been incorporated into, as part of, the Dean of Students'
mm-hmm.
Office. And Health Service, soon after that, did get a new director. And you can see down below here, in the list you've provided me, there were actual specific recommendations for University Health Services that they did follow up on.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we could talk just in general about how these particular recommendations came about,
sure.
I guess.
I think the sense was by the committee was that there were, the campus climate and that lesbian, gay, bisexual, not transgender at the time, but that those issues affected the entire campus and that it was not the responsibility of a single office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think by dividing these recommendations among different sort of large-scale divisions, they wanted to communicate that this was not something that a single office, particularly the Dean of Students' Office, could solve.
Mm-hmm.
That it needed to be being addressed across the campus, and particularly in the venues where students were the target of the service being provided.
Mm-hmm.
And that the places, that what they were trying to do was identify places where they had information from students that there were problems students encountered around being a lesbian, gay, or bisexual person, that these services were not responding to appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
Either that students were feeling targeted, they were feeling ignored, their needs and issues were not being addressed properly.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in Health Service, there was the staff sensitivity issue was around things like the discussion of sexually transmitted diseases and how that was handled with people who, how there was a recognition or no recognition of how that was different for different sexual orientations. The one that came up all the time was lesbians in committed lesbian relationships being kind of pushed and pressured around birth control issues,
mm-hmm.
and they felt this was inappropriate.
Right.
And
these came about because of, were there a sort of an investigation by the committee? Did
yes.
people come and testify,
had,
so to
uh-huh,
speak? Or
actually,
was there,
we had both, we had open hearings, and then we also just sort of did interviews with students.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had several, the committee had open hearing times, I can't remember what they called them, speak outs or something at the time, where they asked people to get students and anyone invited the community to come and talk about these issues and what did they feel that the committee needed to be addressing.
Mm-hmm. And there was a good turnout?
You know, those sorts of things, generally, particularly on a fairly sensitive issue like this, there was a turnout. It wasn't, you know, huge numbers, but we had people come and speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there was a turnout. I think we were very satisfied with the response.
Was it for this report or the later report that there was the surveys and those sorts of things?
Surveys was for the second report.
Okay, all right, we'll get to
that. But wait a minute, take that back. This report also had surveys. This report had extensive surveys. It took many years, a year and a half. That was one of the reasons the report took a long time to produce, is because they did also do surveys. These surveys, were distributed. I know at the 10% dances, and I can't remember how else, but I'm certain at the 10% dances the surveys were distributed. These surveys were primarily to students. The next set of surveys in the 97 report were to both students,
mm-hmm.
staff, and staff and faculty.
So the report then dealt mainly with students, and
yes.
Was it with undergraduates and graduates?
Undergraduates and graduates, and it dealt with students and student life out of classroom life, because the report was to the dean of students, and mm-hmm. her areas of responsibility are out of classroom life, that it didn't make sense to give a curriculum report to the dean of students since she is not responsible for curriculum.
Right. Well, that's why most of the issues do focus on those health and residential life,
yes.
and those sorts of, although there was some about the encouraging gay and lesbian studies on campus, but that
yes.
was a relatively minor part of the entire issue.
Right. This really was a student life and comfort report about students and student services and how they were acting, because
mm-hmm.
those are the areas that the dean of students can respond to.
Mm-hmm. So the report's then published. How would you classify the reaction of the report?
I think the reaction was very positive. We were very careful in the release of the report. I think we released at least two versions before the final report that intentionally we circulated it widely to all of the offices and departments that we felt were connected to these issues and would want to know about these issues to get their feedback. We really solicited feedback and response prior to the final report
mm-hmm.
being put together, and I think that was very effective. I think the reaction was positive all the way around. People were glad it had been written, were very pleased. It was, as far as I know, it was the first major report on these issues in the system.
Mm-hmm.
After ours was completed, there were a number that were rapidly also or either had been in process or were then started and completed at other schools, at Milwaukee, at Whitewater, at Green Bay. But ours was the first in the system, I believe.
Mm-hmm. How would you rate the effectiveness of the report? I guess maybe that's something that it can only be seen long term, but I guess, was there a kind of immediate effect? And
I think it was it's always hard to know what leads to what, and I certainly don't think the report that had there not been a report, some of these other things didn't happen, but I think all the things were coming together at once.
Mm-hmm.
That in looking back, you can see clearly how many things were happening at once, and I think the report helped focus and support the things that came, that followed. That maybe those things would have happened anyway, but I think that it really did help give institutional recognition
mm-hmm.
and institutional attention that then allowed the next steps to be easier for everybody else. I think that what was happening at that time, that there were lots of people across the campus all trying to go towards the same direction. And I think the visibility of the report, the focused attention of the report, the fact that it was in writing and it could be handed to people, all of that really helped. So that at the same time that the report was really being finalized, the campus lesbian, gay, bisexual campus center, the student-run student finance center, was finally approved and begun. The gay, bisexual alumni council through the University through the Wisconsin Alumni Center was begun. There were several new classes begun. There were a lot of student groups getting more active, graduate student groups. So, it really felt like a time when everything was coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wouldn't attribute it to the report, but I think the report helped move everything else along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think since the report, I think the fact that all those things were happening concurrently can be related to that time
mm-hmm.
when there was so much attention being devoted.
Was there a conscious effort made when the report was being drafted to make recommendations? Like, were there some recommendations that people thought were sort of best case scenarios, or, well, we'll put this in here, but we really don't think it's going to happen, or we think was the report maybe optimistic, like here's what we would see in the best of all possible worlds, or was it a realistic, more realistic, pragmatic approach? These are some realistic changes that can be made relatively easily, relatively quickly, or was it a more sort of idealistic kind of?
I'd say it really did a beautiful job of being in the middle,
mm-hmm.
of not I don't think that anybody set their goals very low. I don't think we felt this was sort of the minimum and let's just ask for what we're sure we can get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that was it at all. I also don't think that it, I think that, that it was really forged in order to be. So I think it was a pragmatic report, but not so pragmatic that we're not asking for important issues or asking for things that they felt might take a little bit of work. But I also don't think it wasn't an idealistic report.
Mm-hmm.
that was ridiculous. No way it could happen.
Mm-hmm. The committee had a good sense of the sort of parameters within which they were operating.
I think so. I think that they felt that, you know, the biggest stretch was maybe addressing it to all these different offices, having a section addressed to the chancellor's office. I think they felt saying chancellor should take some responsibility in these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the chancellor's office did try to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And that this report really, I think it was achievable, and most of what was in here did happen.
Now, as a result of the report, or maybe, let me see the dates here, the newsletter
mm-hmm.
was begun several months after the report.
Right, and the newsletter was, again, one of these sort of confluences, I think. The newsletter was an idea brought to me by Ken Schrocka, who was heavily involved in the Gay and Lesbian Alumni Council, at the time called the Gay and Lesbian Alumni Council, now called the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Alumni Council.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken Schrocka had been one of the people I had known ever since I started in the position in the Dean of Students office, because Ken had an informal group, almost entirely men except for me, called Symposium, that was basically gay men on campus who met socially, periodically during the semester. And out of that group, and Ken basically kept that group going. And out of that group, Ken started this idea, working with Tammy Baldwin and Dick Wagner, of starting the Alumni Council.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of these Alumni Council gatherings, which were very informal at that time, or maybe it was even in a phone call. I think it was a phone call to me that Ken suggested, why don't we do a newsletter? There's so much going on, let's start a newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I thought that made good sense, and so then I started it. So it wasn't a direct result of the report, but again, it was because of the fact that the report was happening, the fact that the student center was starting. I think there was just lots going on, and
right.
It tended to generate more ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of the more that's going on, the more that happens.
And the first issue came out in November 1992, and the title, We're Everywhere. How did you come up with that?
That, again, was I talked with lots of people, and it was an idea that came, and I can't remember who. It came from someone in the community, and it just seemed such a great title. It was, in fact, the name of, I believe, a store in Chicago that sold gay tchotchkes.
Uh-huh.
And I think that whoever suggested it did talk to the store owner, and the store owner said, well, as long as you're not really ever going to open a store or do anything, it's okay with me if mm-hmm. you use the name. And it just seemed like such a great name.
And it was designed then as a sort of campus-wide, or was it
yes.
geared towards students in particular?
No,
or just
I'd say it was
general?
Campus-wide. It was definitely. I think it was designed to try to let all these different pockets across the campus know what else was going on, that they weren't alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was really what was needed at the time, and that was really what the liaison's role was, I felt, was really to coordinate information sharing. That there was a lot going on, that people were really working hard in so many different locations, and in different kinds of locations, in a student service location, and in a faculty location, and an administrative unit. But they didn't necessarily know that other people were, so they felt isolated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they felt like they were really out on a limb, and they were willing to be out on a limb and take that risk, but it seemed like people could maybe feel not so risky and still be doing the same work if they were aware of one another a little bit more. And
mm-hmm.
I really think that is what the role of the newsletter served, and I think it served it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should just briefly go back and talk a little bit about you. You had started now the job as the liaison, and you were still only a quarter time.
Right.
Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what your duties were, yeah. or your what.
Well,
your
again, that changed over time. Certainly, one of the big duties was this newsletter we did. I guess it was only 2 a year. I guess it was a fall issue and a spring issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it did take a lot of time because I really worked hard to get articles from all the different corners of campus and people. So to get articles from the primary student organizations on campus and from the Alumni Council and from the Student Center and from faculty that were teaching. So one was the newsletter. I'd say that was a big responsibility. The other things that I began, and they sort of began over the period of being the liaison as the role developed and people knew more, but we started a fall orientation, which is continues to this day, so that every fall we have a resource fair and orientation program. I think the first year it was primarily, well, maybe it's always been both resources. It's just a get-together. for people to welcome new students to the campus, to have some, during our orientation, to have visibility for LGBT issues and students, so that students come to allow returning students and returning faculty and staff to network.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, I think that's been a real successful program, and we've had one every year since probably 1993 was probably the first one. Mm-hmm. I started in 92, and then the next fall is when we first had this orientation. It's advertised in the Wisconsin Welcome booklet. It's definitely an institutionalized part of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one issue. Probably a year or two, I think 94 might have been the first year for this next event, and that's a graduation reception. So that every year, and again, that's been ongoing ever since then. So I guess we've had seven, or maybe I think we've had eight now, to tell you the truth. I'm pretty sure this last one was the eighth annual graduation reception. We have it in conjunction with the student organization's Out and About Week, which is always in April.
Mm-hmm.
We did that initially because it is a graduation reception for graduating LGBT students. We had it earlier than graduation, during Out and About initially, mm-hmm. because at that point it was the case that many LGBT students, when they graduated with family, were not graduating as LGBT students, that they either weren't out to their families or their families were not accepting them of them as LGBT students, so that it was really a graduation that couldn't involve them in their whole person. And so we felt by having it during the semester when family were not necessarily around,
mm-hmm.
people could be acknowledged as their whole person and congratulated as a graduate.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's changing, and whether we'll decide to move it to the more traditional time of graduation receptions or not, it will be interesting to see. At the last two graduation receptions, I believe all of the students that have been especially recognized, we generally invite students to speak and give them some awards. I believe that the students who have received those awards have all had family attend the events.
Hmm.
But that's been a change.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I think that was the first year we'd ever really had students either want to invite their families or the families want to come. I don't know which it was, but we hadn't had families.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like we're always getting families. So that's a wonderful change.
Mm, definitely.
But it's also always been terrific to have it as part of Out and About. Out and About has helped us publicize it. It's been listed among the events in the Out and About Week, which is usually, you know, seven or eight different events. So, again, that's been, I think, a nice collaboration between students' activities and faculty and staff. We've always had a good attendance by faculty and staff in support of students.
Mm-hmm.
We usually have a couple of student speakers, and this year we didn't have a faculty speaker. Other years we've always also had a faculty speaker.
Mm-hmm. And that's done through the Dean of Students office?
It's a collaboration between our office and the Wisconsin Alumni Association, the
mm-hmm.
and the council, the Alumni Council. It's really an event of the council. It's paid for in large part by the council. A lot of the administration and planning was through this office and then also the Alumni Association.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I was going to ask, if that was different. I knew that there was an event where the alumni were brought in to speak. Is that a different event, or is that the same?
That's a different event, and that's also an alumni council event.
Right.
That is a brunch. It's the part of the bylaws of the Alumni Council in any Wisconsin Alumni Association organization is that there be an annual meeting. Mm-hmm. So the annual meeting for the Gay and Lesbian Alumni Council is a summer event where we recognize distinguished alumni and we have a brunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are generally two distinguished alumni that we recognize come in and speak, and we give them an award.
Mm-hmm.
We now also, the Alumni Council now also has a scholarship award for gay and lesbian students, and that's given out at the alumni brunch. Mm-hmm. The alumni brunch is what's known as the Magic Picnic Weekend in Madison, which is a weekend of events for the gay and lesbian community.
Mm-hmm.
There is this Magic Picnic, which is a picnic with vendors and all kinds of just a gathering, and then there is usually a Pride March that weekend as well, and then our alumni brunch is that weekend, so it's mm-hmm. kind of a full weekend of activities. It's usually mid-July.
Well, since we're talking a little bit about the Alumni Council, you had mentioned that was one of these things that had started to coalesce around 1992, seems to be the magic date. Well, maybe could you describe a little bit more in detail the how that came about?
Yes, and that's also had a very interesting development in history. It started again, really, Ken Schrocka talking with Tammy Baldwin, who at that point was a representative,
mm-hmm.
Or an assembly member, sorry. She is now a U.S. representative. She was a Wisconsin assembly member. And with Dick Wagner, who is a state employee, longtime state employee. And the three of them decided that the Alumni Council should start, or that the Wisconsin Alumni Group should start a special interest group for gay and lesbian mm-hmm. people. They had done such for Native Americans and for African Americans and for Chicanos, and we felt it was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
They had approached Paula Bonner, who was an employee of the Alumni Association. She is currently the executive director. At that point, she was not. I believe she was the associate director or mm-hmm. assistant director. And started, Paula was very supportive and said, sure, go for it, get together and set up bylaws. So probably 10 or 12 people, and I was fortunate to be included, started meeting at people's homes. Dick Wagner is a wonderful host, is well known in Madison as having a beautiful home and a wonderful host, and he would have us to his house and make these wonderful muffins and biscuits and lay out a beautiful spread on weekends. And we started the Alumni Association. We put together a mission and a set of bylaws. The Alumni Association accepted us as an official mm-hmm. organization.
So there is a kind of technical process
that
any group has to go through to become an official.
That's right.
Officially recognized
and actually,
part of the Alumni Association.
That was, so there's that first step which makes you recognized but not yet official, and then we also went through the next step probably took about a year and a half through the Alumni Association Board of Directors. I'm not sure, I can't remember what they're called right now,
mm-hmm.
where the governing structure for the entire board, or for the entire association, did recognize us as an official organization.
Mm-hmm.
And that made us one of the very first and few in the country that were officially organized. Many alumni associations have LGBT groups, but most are not official.
Mm-hmm.
They're just informal, and ours is official. So
and there were never any problems?
Never.
It was just...
Never. They were
just
the alumni
a question
association.
Of going through the process. Then.
Yes, the Alumni Association has been wonderfully supportive from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They would, and in the there is this alumni magazine that's published periodically, and they would publish articles about the activities of the Gay and Lesbian Council. They would publish pictures from the annual brunch. They were always extremely supportive and never seemed at all shy
mm-hmm.
about putting that information in the newsletter. Which was a risk at that point, I think.
Right. What was there a big I mean, how successful, I guess, has the Alumni Council, is it turned into a very large group, or?
I think it's a very successful group. It's expanded, it's formalized itself. As I said, it used to be that we met for the first probably 2 or 3 years, we met in people's homes, mm-hmm. which was lovely and informal. But then when the Alumni Association got its new below house, I believe it's pronounced, the new building, since that building's been in existence, we now meet there, mm-hmm. or the organization now meets there. And the structure has been more formalized. There's a real effort, and it's been very successful in getting younger alumni in. I would say that the group that started it, except for Tammy, was probably the youngest of the group that started it. Most of the members of the group that began, I would say, were in their late 40s and 50s. And now I would say the group is primarily people in their 30s and even 20s.
Oh, really?
There's been a real effort to involve recent alums, and I think mm-hmm. that's been very successful. The activities of the council have expanded. When the council first began, the major event was this brunch, where we did, and the real goal of the brunch was to recognize the very famous and outstanding alum who were a gay and lesbian, mm-hmm. and who had then gone on and made major contributions in the world. So the brunch was the first event. Soon after the brunch began, there was a homecoming event that began, and that also has continued. At homecoming, the Alumni Council would buy a block of tickets for the game mm-hmm. that they would make available to council members. And there would also be usually often a very elegant I'm thinking it's tailback, what do they call it?
Oh, tailgate.
Tailgate, thank you, tailgate party. Sometimes at alum houses, and sometimes in a parking lot, like mm-hmm. other tailgates, with brats and beer and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. In the very first years of that, also, sometimes Dick Wagner would have a more elegant event the night before. That hasn't continued now. Mm-hmm. That happened probably 4 or 5 years, and now as Dick is no longer as involved in the Alumni Council, it hasn't continued.
I suppose, too, as it gets bigger, if yes. there's only a handful or a
right.
dozen people involved, really, then it can be a much smaller, but now it can be a much bigger affair, I suppose.
I would say, even at the very beginning, both the tailgate and the dinner before probably had 30 to 50 people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And now I think the tailgate still has around, you know, anywhere from 50 to 70 attend.
Wow.
Yeah. No, so it's a well-attended event.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Alumni Council also started off planning, usually, that was in collaboration. It was part of the homecoming event. They would often bring in a speaker, some sort of major speaker, to give a lecture. That was how that happened. We would invite a major speaker to come in, give a lecture on LGBT issues. That would be the afternoon before the homecoming game. Then that evening, that's what Dick's party was. Dick's party was sort of a reception for the speaker.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
then the next day was the tailgate and the game. Mm-hmm. And I'd say in general, the speaking has, inviting a speaker has also continued.
Mm-hmm. And that would be an alum or
not necessarily an alum, just a major speaker. Mm-hmm. That was not necessarily an alum. Just a major speaker doing some sort of research or important work on LGBT issues.
Mm-hmm.
Since then has also been added this scholarship that I talked about, which is there are two now scholarships for LGBT students. That's in collaboration with the foundation. Foundation has helped put the money together in the Alumni Association. It's a scholarship for a continuing student. I believe you need to be a sophomore or junior to be eligible. So it's not, seniors are not eligible and freshmen are not eligible, and at this point grad students are not eligible, mm-hmm. but the Alumni Association and the foundation are hoping to extend it to graduate students in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
There are, I think I was looking at the website. Mm-hmm. And there are awards.
Yes, and then
in addition to the scholarships for graduating
seniors.
That's
right, and there are also now awards for graduating seniors.
that are also given out at the brunch.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, so there's two different sort of ways of acknowledging and recognizing LGBT students. There's the scholarship and an award.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there are two of each, actually.
Okay. Well, the newsletters is going, there's the liaison position, all these things are happening, but then there was a letter that you had written to the university committee.
Yeah, after...
Perhaps you could, in March 4, 1994,
right.
And perhaps you'd like to explain the genesis and maybe what the letter, what the purpose,
sure,
I guess.
Sure. So the Gay and Lesbians Issues Committee continues to function. The report's been published. The recommendations are taking effect. And people are seeing real positive change in the area of student life.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of services and awareness of LGBT issues around a student's activities on the campus. What continues, or what then we start to notice, is that the issues that aren't getting attention are the ones that weren't addressed in this report,
right,
because it was a Dean of Students report.
Mm-hmm.
And those were issues of curriculum and career and employment issues for faculty and staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim Stakely, who was chair of the committee, and I started talking and saying, those aren't areas that the Dean of Students can do anything about. What do we need to do in order to get those areas attended to get attention there?
Mm-hmm.
So Jim and I went to Betsy Drain and Gary Sandifer, who at the time were associate vice chancellors. And we said, here's where we think we need to be putting attention as a campus. How should we be doing that? How might we establish a committee that could pay attention to curricular issues and career issues for
mm-hmm.
faculty and staff, career employment issues? And what Betsy and Gary said is that they recommended not a task force, which the chancellor could appoint in a minute,
mm-hmm.
but a standing university committee that would be ongoing and wouldn't just dissolve once the report was published.
Mm-hmm. What, is that the difference between the
two,
basically?
That's the difference. A task force is something that a chancellor or anybody can just pull together to work on an issue, and then once they've done the assigned task, it dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
A committee that's part of governance continues. It's a part of the structure of the university. If it's
so
a governance,
it establishes a kind of permanent presence then,
exactly,
within the administrative hierarchy or
the governing
network,
structure.
Right, the governing structure of
right.
the university. Okay.
Exactly. And they strongly recommended that was where we go rather mm-hmm. than ask for a task force.
Now, would this committee be different than the GLIT committee, or would it serve similar functions as well? Or
the GLIT committee was an informal committee appointed by the dean to report to her to give her information.
Oh, okay. So that was a thing within the context of the Dean of Students office and not within the governmental structure
exactly.
of the university.
Exactly. It wasn't
okay.
university-wide.
Mm-hmm.
It reported to the dean. It was appointed by the dean.
Right. Was there a sense that the university committee then would take over these, the issues? I guess, would the university committee deal with the two issues you mentioned, the curriculum and the faculty staff, but then would also deal with student issues, or was
it certainly
designed
could address
to be
students.
Sort of just separate?
I think it could address student issues. I think there was the sense that the dean, at this point, was adequately addressing student issues.
Okay.
Certainly this committee would not ignore student issues.
Right.
They could bring a new perspective and provide that to the dean, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the sense was that there needed to be a structure for getting those other two issues addressed,
mm-hmm.
and also student issues. So, Betsy and Gary conferred with us and told us how they would recommend we proceed if that was our goal. And what they said we should do is that we needed to make a proposal to the university committee, that they recommended this be a committee of the university committee, and that the best way to approach the university committee would be to be able to demonstrate that we had support among faculty. So Jim and I contacted a lot of people around campus. We drafted a proposal as to what this committee would address, and the things that we primarily mentioned in that
mm-hmm.
were career and employment issues and curriculum issues. And we got 40 individuals to sign it. I think they were primarily faculty because this was a, we were taking it to the university committee, which mm-hmm. is the governing body for the faculty senate. So we wanted to have clear demonstration of faculty support.
Okay.
We did have staff on there as well, but we really tried to load it with faculty.
Right.
And we presented it. I believe we met with the university committee twice. I think initially to present the idea, and they said, yes, go ahead, sounds good to us, get this sort of support and bring it back to us. We then met with them and presented to them our proposal and the petition supporting the proposal signed by these 40 individuals. And we were very excited and gratified that what the university committee decided to do was to not then say, fine, go and present it to the faculty senate yourselves. They decided they would take it on and they would propose it, which is a significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they can sort of say, okay, we'll give you time, or they can say, we will make this our recommendation to the faculty senate. And they did the second.
Mm-hmm.
So that in May then, so we presented the letter to them in March, and in May, at the last meeting of the faculty senate for the year, the university committee took our proposal and presented it to the faculty senate with their recommendation that it be accepted,
mm-hmm.
which was huge. And it was accepted. I believe there was almost no dissension. There may have been one or two people who stood up and said something mildly negative, but it was certainly not hugely controversial or negative,
mm-hmm.
and it passed. And so starting in the next academic year, the Faculty Senate Issues Committee was in place.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Stakely was the first chair of that committee.
And then, were you a part of that, or that's just for faculty?
No,
or were you a part of that committee?
That was a university committee, or university, Faculty Senate committees involve students and academic staff as well. They are composed primarily of faculty, but they also have representatives from academic staff and students.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I was a part of that committee as well.
Okay.
I believe it initially had 4 or 5 faculty members and 2 academic staff and 2 students was, I think, the initial makeup. So once that committee was in place, in order to sort of to respond to your earlier question about what about GLIC, once we had that committee in place and it had 5 faculty members, it didn't make sense to continue to set up the GLIC committee with 3 faculty members and 3 staff, that it was just starting to draw on too many people.
Right.
So we changed the structure of GLIC to make it a more student-focused committee that could then get student feedback primarily. And since I was on both committees, and that was always the sense that whoever was liaison would be on, would be at least very closely connected or reporting to
mm-hmm.
both committees, we could get a committee that had strong faculty and staff representation and some student representation, and then something through the Dean of Students Office that could be talking to a wider group of students and hearing from more students on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's happened now, that the new full-time liaison has her own student working group and regularly reports to the Faculty Senate Committee.
So the GLIC has sort of transformed into that student working group.
Yes,
like you said.
GLIC has been through actually several transformations, and it is, and all of them were sort of to increase the student representation and student voice as a way to get student information to the Dean of Students Office and also to the Faculty Senate Committee.
Oh, so it's become a kind of a way for the dean to keep
in touch with students.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the dean's responsibility, so that makes sense.
Rather
than the dean having to be getting information from faculty and staff.
Now that the faculty committee is established, what did you see were the goals, or what next, I guess, is the
first issue I think that the faculty senate committee took on was a report, and I think that the clear issue was what started our whole process of trying to get the committee together,
it was a curricular issue, is that there was a sense that the university was no longer cutting edge, because there were many places around the country that had gay and lesbian studies programs where mm-hmm. important research was being done, and that wasn't happening on our campus, that we were hearing from scholars wanting to pursue that as young assistant professors, not having support to do that or wanting to leave in order to do it elsewhere, from graduate students wanting to pursue gay and lesbian studies dissertations, feeling they couldn't do that here, from undergraduates wanting to write papers on gay and lesbian studies, not knowing where they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a clear sense from the very first meeting, I think, that a studies program or a certificate program, somehow figuring out how do we infuse the curriculum better, mm-hmm. was a high priority.